This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, Congress passed a fiscal spending bill last week and the president signed it. While the government won't shut down, there will be some changes to healthcare funding moving forward. The CDC and the National Institute of Health will receive more funding. But Congress failed to act on stabilizing the insurance markets under the Affordable Care Act, and that means rates are almost guaranteed to go up on the insurance marketplaces next year.
But since Congress failed to include stabilization measures in the budget omnibus, rates may now be going up, they say, by as much as 2,000% by next year, which seems almost unbelievable. And this is going to be particularly true for older Americans with more complex health histories.
The insurance market stabilization subsidies were an integral part of the Affordable Care Act to help insurers offer customers lower rates on the insurance exchanges. But the Trump administration failed to renew those subsidies, and insurers say they will have no choice but to raise rates for 2019. As you say, Margaret, this will impact older health consumers who often have more expensive pre-existing conditions.
And all of this dovetails to our guest today. Dr. Charles Alessi is a primary care physician with the National Health Service in England. He'll be talking about the impact on population health when an entire country has access to primary care.
And I'll also talk about a health issue that is of great concern all around the world, the expected increase in the number of people being diagnosed with some form of dementia. He developed some very interesting prevention strategies that are being deployed in the UK. Really looking forward to that conversation, Margaret.
And Laurie Robertson will stop by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Charles Alessi of Public Health England in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Winners and losers in the congressional budget deal signed by President Trump, which keeps the federal government afloat while securing more money for things like the opioid epidemic and mental health services. The overall budget for the Department of Health and Human Services increased by $10 billion overall. Congress approved $3.6 billion to help battle the opioid addiction crisis. With the NIH did well, their budget of $37 billion showed $3 billion more than last year, with money earmarked for Alzheimer's research, as well as a quest for a universal flu vaccine. Noticeably absent from the bill was a plan to stabilize the insurance markets. After the Trump administration had removed the Affordable Care Act's subsidies to insurers to help them keep rates down on the individual market, the Congressional Budget Office and a number of independent analysts predict it's going to mean much higher insurance rates for folks in 2019. U.S. News and World Report has launched its first official rankings of the nation's healthiest cities, with tiny 2-mile-square town of Falls Church, Virginia, taking the number one spot. The rankings, done in partnership with the Aetna Foundation, were compiled based on a number of criteria: population health overall, equity, education, economy, housing quality, and healthy food and nutrition. In the rankings released Monday, the top five communities were Falls Church City, Virginia, Douglas County, Colorado, Broomfield County, Colorado, Los Alamos County, New Mexico, and Dukes County, Massachusetts. He's been confirmed. Dr. Robert Redfield, the new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The longtime researcher rose to prominence in the world of HIV/AIDS discoveries. He's also been a longtime advocate of drug addiction treatment to reduce the rate of HIV infection, which is much higher among IV drug users. The recent CDC director, Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald, Donald Trump's first pick, resigned over financial conflicts of interest. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Charles Alessi, Senior Advisor for Dementia Prevention at Public Health England, the United Kingdom's public health agency dedicated to protecting and improving population health. Dr. Alessi is a longtime primary care physician with a focus on strategies that can prevent the onset of dementia. He has served as chairman of the National Association for Primary Care in the UK. He's currently a professor in the MBA in Health Innovation Program, as well as professor of clinical Clinical Neuroscience at Western Ontario University in Canada. Dr. Alessi, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and as a primary care clinician with a long history working with the NHS, England's national system, there are some similarities, but also vast differences between our respective health systems. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners how the National Health Service functions in delivering care across the UK.
The NHS was set up just after the Second World War, and basically it delivers healthcare free at the point of delivery to the population of England, irrespective of the ability of people to pay for the service. So it delivers healthcare on the basis of clinical need. In other words, there's a single insurer, and that single insurer is government. It's paid for out of the taxes associated with the way we pay tax in the United Kingdom. The NHS is open to everybody, and classically what tends to happen is the moment somebody's born, they tend to register, or rather their parents tend to register them with a general practitioner who holds their clinical record. And that clinical record is held by that general practitioner for the whole of that individual's life. That doesn't mean, of course, that that individual can't change general practitioner. They choose to change their practitioner, but only one record is kept for an individual, and there is only one practitioner which is responsible for their care. The registered list is the way we describe that. This has significant advantages because what tends to develop is a very long-standing relationship, a lifelong relationship between an individual and their clinician. Actually, 90% of all clinical episodes take place in primary care. Only about 10% take place in hospitals.
We have always been so intrigued to talk with our British counterparts about this sense of everyone having access to comprehensive primary care, and not just primary care, but all health services with little or no out-of-pocket costs, something that eliminates so many barriers for people. So what is your analysis of what happens to population health, to the health of your country and the population in general, in the presence of this national access to primary care?
Well, I wish I could say that the solution is purely around access to primary care, but we still have levels of inequality within our system which are associated with lower socioeconomic groups, which despite the fact that they have access to primary care facilities, often choose not to access them, despite the fact that they are not charged any money to access them at all. People choose not to access them, despite the fact that we have services which are open to everybody. And I think we can learn from other countries in terms of the way we manage disease. If you look to some jurisdictions, places like Singapore, where people have a real understanding associated with sense of community and sense of belonging to a community, people tend to access services better than perhaps we do in the West. And I think part of that is also our responsibility as clinicians, because we tend to practice what I call medicine by body part. So one lesson I think we need to learn is primary care services are incredibly important, of course, because it's the only way you can manage a population. You can't really eliminate clinical risk from every individual by each individual going to hospital when they need to. It just doesn't work like that. And we have very good examples of how it doesn't work, particularly in terms of the amount of money it costs to exclude illness without getting clinical benefits associated with it. But what is important in a primary care environment needs to be sensitive to their culture, needs to be sensitive to their needs, and preferably needs to be delivered by people who are amongst them. In other words, having neighborhood arrangements is probably the best way to deliver services. And that has certainly been the experience of a lot of middle-income countries that have developed primary care services, and some of which have really quite excellent health services in general.
Let's take a closer look at your specific areas of expertise and your ongoing work at Public Health England, and that's the prevention of dementia. Our health system, as well as yours, is bracing for what's being referred to as a silver tsunami, with millions of Americans as well as Britons already diagnosed with some form of dementia. And I wonder if you could again share with our listeners some of the strategies for dementia preventions being deployed under your direction.
Thank you. Well, I mean, the key message is of what's good for your heart is good for your brain. dementia is not an inevitable and normal part of aging, even though aging is one of the risk factors associated with dementia. And there are ways to reduce the risk of developing dementia, and many of these are common to reducing cardiovascular risk. These are taking regular exercise. This is particularly important. Not smoking. This is extremely important. Healthy, balanced diet, maintaining a healthy weight, and keeping socially and mentally active. Social engagement is really important. And education is also really important. So really managing to try to remain engaged and involved with your community is of extreme importance. This also includes ensuring you manage risk factors like blood pressure, ensuring you manage your diabetes particularly well if you are diabetic, and ensuring that if you have something like atrial fibrillation, which is a condition associated with an irregular heartbeat, that is properly treated. The science isn't quite as good as it could be yet. We're not sure exactly why. There's an association between pollution, for example, mm-hmm. and particulates. There's another association between hearing loss. Perhaps it's associated with social isolation. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly an association with depression.
Well, Dr. Alessi, you've said that the problems of aging are not going to be solved just by the medical community, but by a greater understanding of activity within the community. And you've noted that sometimes interventions as simple as a national walking program, which I understand has proven successful in the UK to help treat depression, is to get people more active. These things both have a significant impact, but we know in healthcare that behavior change can be a heavy lift. And maybe you could talk with us a bit about some of the community-based initiatives that the National Health Service may be engaged in, but that are really being carried out at the community level.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I think this is really important. Giving people meaning and purpose in life is of fundamental importance. You know, what would I do if I woke up every morning and I didn't know why I was here, what I was going to do today? Being in employment, in other words, being connected with the people around you, knowing who your neighbors are, helping your neighbors, trying to learn something every day, this is all part of giving people meaning and purpose. And I think a lot of what we're trying to do is to ensure we give people meaning and purpose. The walking program was a mechanism because, one, it got people to talk to each other, which was particularly helpful because it started to engage people with their neighbors. But while they were doing that, they were also improving their step count, which we know is of value anyway. So, you know, you're killing two birds with one stone. But the most important thing is to remain connected. Now, if you do that through work, or you do that through hobbies, or you do that through helping people, I don't think it really matters as long as you feel you have meaning and purpose in your life. If you don't, then life doesn't start to be worth living. And we see the effect of that really quite readily in how long it takes for people to die. People tend to die relatively quickly when they lose meaning and purpose in life.
We're speaking today with Dr. Charles Alessi, Senior Advisor for Dementia Prevention at Public Health England, the UK's public health agency dedicated to protecting and improving population health and reducing public health inequities. Dr. Alessi is a longtime primary care physician with a focus on strategies that can prevent the onset of dementia. Dr. Alessi, you always hear the new axiom in the public health space, such as sitting is the new smoking, which has led to a lot of innovative approaches to address our sedentary lifestyle. But we're really taken by the recent revelations that there's also an epidemic of loneliness, especially among seniors, and that the effects from such isolation are just as damaging to health and longevity as sitting or smoking. You know, I'm thinking about the work of Dr. Robert Putnam here in the United States, who wrote Bowling Alone. Your country has adopted a novel approach. I wonder if you could talk about your new Minister of Loneliness in the UK, and how will that person be addressing these newly recognized public health challenges of chronic loneliness?
We're very aware of the dangers of loneliness. I mean, the dangers of social isolation are very well described in the literature. The moment somebody becomes socially isolated on retirement, the health effects of that are equivalent to them taking up smoking on retirement. I mean, it really does have a significant effect upon one's life. So it's really quite important to think in terms of ways in which one manages the situation. Of course, this is not something which was terribly common when we lived in small villages and knew each other, but is becoming much more common as the old family values, which existed in the middle of the 20th century, become less prevalent in the 21st, and also with city dwelling, where many of us don't even know who our neighbours are. So a lot of what the work of government and local government is around loneliness is ensuring that we develop things like befriending services. And we work very closely with our voluntary agencies, the equivalent of AARP and various other charities, to ensure that we develop services that befriend people, that try to introduce adult learning, all sorts of mechanisms, and the walking initiative was just one of them, ensuring that people feel there's somebody who cares about them, and ensuring that if possible people care about somebody else. We know those two things really make a difference to outcomes. They also make a difference if you have a long-term condition, which in some people leads you to remain lying in bed all day, but if you have a particular interest, you may actually be able to live with that condition for longer because your life is more important, you're busy. And I think this is the sense of trying to ensure people retain meaning. And that's why loneliness is something, and social isolation is something we're attacking with quite a significant amount of resource in England.
Well, Dr. Alessi, you obviously bring a depth and richness of the years of being a physician, a primary care provider, and a leader in the United Kingdom's primary care system. But you're also an educator. And you've noted that health systems are at a dramatic turning point, and therefore the way we teach and the way we train needs to be at a turning point. How has this changed the way that you and your colleagues are training this next generation of clinicians?
We have a lot of work to do around training of physicians because the world is changing more rapidly than we can change the curricula of medical schools. People like me were trained in a period when we accumulate a whole series of levels of information and knowledge to be able to impart those to people. So basically, we told people what to do. And what's happened now with the digital revolution is that information is available to everybody. The availability of information immediately, it is really important that clinicians understand that their role is changing to one where they have to accompany people and one where they don't need to tell people what to do, but they need to guide people around what they advise people to do. And I think that's a fundamental difference to the way I was trained as a physician in the 1970s. Now I think it's more about accompanying somebody on a life journey around their non-communicable diseases and being somebody who they can turn to and somebody who can help them make decisions. What's also changed is the personalization of healthcare. People are behaving far more like consumers, and I think that's not necessarily a bad thing because I think we need to understand that the system is changing and healthcare needs to change like everything else has changed in the 21st century.
Dr. Alessi, let me pull the thread on that transformation that you've been talking about in the health system. You've talked very passionately about, you know, make geography irrelevant. You know, we can start delivering these cares by Skype, and we have to really reform our system and leverage these technological advances. Where do you see the greatest promise for disruption and improvement with these technological changes advancing?
I think digital health is going to revolutionize medicine because the fact that information is going to be available to everybody readily is going to potentially reduce the inequalities we've been talking about. And people will be able to do much more for themselves. Self-care will become much commoner. And together with initiatives which will arise out of artificial intelligence, physicians that are actually not physicians but chatbots, physicians that are really decision aids will be able to actually help us manage our healthcare and make decisions better. Of course, there always will be the need for a physician, and I think the big challenge really is where the digital world hits the old-fashioned personal world. And I think managing that interface is going to be the biggest challenge. Either all the people in the world will change, or it's up to the medical system to change. And I would suggest it's up to the medical system to change because it's not very likely the whole world will change. But really, the big change is around the metrics that drive our systems. At the moment, a lot of the health systems we have are driven around activity. Mm-hmm. And I think they need to move and turn to being driven by wellness. We pay our physicians when we're sick. I reckon we should pay them when we're well. Mm. That change of mindset is really what's going to drive the new world and the new way of thinking.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Charles Alessi, the Senior Advisor for Dementia Prevention at Public Health England. You can learn more about their work by going to gov.uk/government/organization/Public Health England or follow them on Twitter at @PHE_UK. #Dr. Charles Alessi. Dr. Alessi, we want to thank you so much for the important work that you are doing and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Several readers have asked us about a popular Facebook post that claims President Donald Trump, quote, signed an executive order allowing our veterans to get 100% medical bills paid at hospitals other than a VA hospital. No such executive order was ever signed. We could find no evidence to support the post in either news reports or White House statements. What Trump has done is continue the Veterans Choice Program, a program started in 2014 following a scandal over wait times at Veterans Affairs facilities, a bipartisan bill that was signed by President Barack Obama. The Veterans Choice Program allows some veterans who experience difficulty obtaining care from a Veterans Affairs medical facility to seek care elsewhere. Veterans must be enrolled in the VA healthcare system and demonstrate that they've faced barriers to using the VA system. Last year, Trump signed a bill that eliminated the program's expiration date and twice signed legislation that authorized continued funding for the program. Under the Veterans Choice Program, care isn't necessarily free. Veterans might have co-payments depending on their financial status. So while Trump has extended this Obama-era program that covers some medical care for certain eligible veterans outside the VA system, he has not signed any executive order that would allow veterans to get free care at any hospital, as this post spread through Facebook says. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Healthcare providers are forever on the lookout for that magic elixir that can cure a host of chronic ills in one step. And in the case of obesity, depression, anxiety, and stress, that elixir could be a number of steps, as in taking a hike. A large study conducted by several institutions, including the University of Michigan and Edge Hill University in the UK, looked at the medicinal benefits derived from regular group hikes conducted in nature. Researchers evaluated some 2,000 participants in a program called Walking for Health in England, which sponsors some 3,000 walks per week across the country.
You know, this is a national study in the UK. There was investment in these walking groups.
Dr. Sarah Warber, professor of family medicine at the University of Michigan School of Medicine, said this study showed a dramatic improvement in the mental well-being of participants.
Depression was reduced, perceived stress was reduced, and that people experienced more positive feelings or positive emotions. And we have less negative emotions when we're out in nature and when we're out in nature in a group.
Dr. Warber says this is the first study that revealed the added benefits of group hikes in nature and significant mitigation of depression. Walk for Health, a simple guided group nature hike program which incentivizes folks suffering from depression and anxiety to step into the fresh air with others, improving their mood, reducing their depression. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.